Hi, I'm Eloy Ortiz Oakley, and welcome back to The Rant, the podcast where we pull back the curtain and break down the people, the policies, and the politics of our higher education system. In this episode, I get to talk with Jeff Magincalda, the CEO of Coursera. Coursera is one of the trailblazers of the massive open online course movement, otherwise known as MOOCs, and it has evolved into one of the world's largest learning platforms, offering more than 4,000 courses. We will discuss Coursera's roots, its evolution, and how it's harnessing the power of generative AI. So, Jeff, welcome to The Rant.
Hey, it's great to be here, Eloy. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, it's great to have you on the podcast, Jeff, and appreciate you taking the time. Now, you've been leading Coursera since 2017, and you've seen many changes along the way, changes in the company, changes in the MOOC universe and the movement. However, before we get into all of that, I'd love to just spend a little bit of time getting to know you better and making sure that our listeners get to know you. So tell us a little bit about your higher education journey and what led you to this leadership role at Coursera.
Well, thanks. I grew up in California and ended up going to Stanford as an undergrad. I always loved English. And so I was an English major. And my dad, my freshman year, said, you know, Jeff, I'm not paying for Stanford if you get an English degree. That's not going to make you any money. And I was like a semi-rebel. So I thought, all right, I'll give my dad what he wants. But I decided I was still going to be an English major. Mm-hmm. And I double majored in quantitative economics and English. So I did a little bit of the right side of the brain and a little bit of the left side of the brain. So I was at Stanford.
Graduated. Well, I have two English majors of my kids, so there's hope for them.
Absolutely. Well, tell them they should also do something in economics or computer programming. So I did that. I worked at a litigation consulting firm for a few years doing like statistical and financial analysis for business litigation. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to the Stanford Business School and got an MBA. I was planning to go to McKinsey, and then I got this incredible, I mean, literally once in a lifetime opportunity where one of the professors at Stanford, Bill Sharp, who's a Nobel Prize winner in economics, mm-hmm. he said, hey, I want to start a tech company. This was in 1996. The internet was just starting. And he said, right. I want to basically do investment advice for 401k participants. Do you want to write a business plan and try to get it funded? So I was the first employee at Financial Engines back in 1996. Uh-huh. I was a CEO there for 18 years. We tried so many ways to build a successful company. And like on our fifth try, it finally clicked. And we found something that people really wanted. And mm-hmm. it ended up going public. And it turned out to be a great success. But not after years and years of work right. and everything and nearly losing my job multiple times. And then I took a few years off, and then I got kind of a second in a lifetime opportunity, I guess, because another pair of Stanford professors, this time at Coursera, said, hey, we're looking for a CEO. Would you be interested in applying? And, mm-hmm. and I fell in love with the idea, and I'm the luckiest guy in the world to have been given the opportunity.
Wow. Well, that's a great story. And it seemed like all roads kept leading back to Stanford for you.
It seems that way. Right now, you know, I'm in Palo Alto. I live 5 minutes away. Yeah, I don't know. It's great. Good weather out here.
Yes. So let's talk about Coursera. And, you know, you may know this, but when I was president of Long Beach City College, I had the opportunity and the privilege to host a meeting of the California Little Hoover Commission. At that time, there was a lot of interest in the MOOC movement and some of the stuff that was happening throughout California. And so way back in February of 2013, we hosted the Little Hoover Commission on campus of Long Beach City College. And testifying at that meeting were Sebastian Thrun from Udacity and Daphne Kohler, the co-founder of Coursera.
Oh my gosh, Eli, you're such a trailblazer. That was the very beginning.
That was the beginning. And it was such a fun and interesting hearing. And of course, some of the things that Daphne and Sebastian were talking about have come to fruition. Some things have still evolving, but nonetheless, for folks who are interested in a retrospective of the early days of the MOOC movement, that is such an interesting hearing that people can find it on YouTube still if they're interested. So, Let me turn back to you and Coursera. So a lot has happened since February of 2013. Tell us about Coursera today. How has the company evolved, and who are the learners that you're serving today?
Well, it certainly has changed, but you know, some of the things are still fundamentally the same. Mm-hmm. What is the same is the underpinnings of the promise, which is that high quality education using technology can be made available to everyone. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably talk about AI, but right. Many technologies, including mobile phones, including 5G, including AI, are increasing in many ways the accessibility of education and the effectiveness of education. So I think, you know, some things are the same, which mm-hmm. is that kind of open access online to great educators. And then I think it's enhanced, and the business is enhanced too. We started, as you remember, back in the early days, it was sort of open courses mm-hmm. being delivered directly to individuals on the internet. And that was it. It was, you know, massively open online courses. That went along for quite some time, and it was just universities doing it. Mm-hmm. A first extension was not just the founding starting universities, which was like Stanford and Yale and Michigan and Penn, I think. But then more universities started publishing courses. Universities outside of the U.S. started publishing courses. And then we had industry start publishing courses. This is in the 2017 time period, maybe 2020, mm-hmm. maybe before that, 2016. So we started having universities and industry creating courses. Then another major innovation was, and this was under Rick Levin, who preceded mm-hmm. me as CEO, they started offering Coursera not only directly to individuals, but also to institutions. First to businesses through Coursera for Business, where businesses were looking to upskill and reskill their employees, and they couldn't send them all back to college. You know, it turns out working adults have jobs and often have families, and they can't just show up on campus. So the flexibility of online learning and the breadth of content, especially in data science, computer science, very appealing to companies. A year later, in 2017, we launched Coursera for Government. Mm-hmm. And then in 2019, October, just a few months before the pandemic, we launched Coursera for Campus. And this is a version of Coursera for colleges and universities that want to subscribe to these online courses and build the courses into the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so it turned out to be pretty good timing because, you know, a few months later, basically every single university and school in the world closed. 1.6 right. billion students were couldn't go to a class. And so, you know, many of them started learning online. So those are some of the big innovations. And I'd say that a couple of other quick ones are, number one, using these open courses as part of degree programs. So mm-hmm. now there's many degrees that are built on MOOCs with their fully accredited degrees from University of Pennsylvania, University of Michigan, Imperial College of London, you know, all kinds of great schools. Mm-hmm. And then on the industry side, they've kind of expanded as well, not just a MOOC, but a series of MOOCs in what we call professional certificates. Mm-hmm. These are job training programs that are created by Google and Microsoft and IBM and Amazon and others. It's definitely expanded.
Well, a lot has been happening. We've heard a lot about the importance of reskilling and upskilling in the American workforce, and you just touched on some of the work that you're doing. But how can cross-sector collaboration contribute to the reskilling revolution and effectively address the supply side challenges? What crucial role do employees play in supporting workforce reskilling and upskilling efforts? Because this is certainly something that a lot of different organizations and agencies are thinking about as the economy and the workforce continues to change.
It really is an ecosystem of collaboration that's going to be required. I mean, just governments can't really do it on their own. Mm-hmm. Just universities can't do it on their own. It's really sort of collaboration among the big stakeholders. So when we have 300 universities and industry partners creating, there's about 6,000 courses now. These institutions that author on Coursera come from around the world. So mm-hmm. both in industry and universities. We have about 130 million individual learners all around the world. Wow. And so, you know, we have a broad constituent of learners from different countries, different backgrounds, different genders, et cetera, and they're coming to Coursera mostly to advance their careers, but, you know, different types of careers. But especially when we started doing Coursera for Business, Government, and Campus, things got interesting. Mm-hmm. And what we find is this. I mean, they each have different roles to play. Generally speaking, the business is kind of at the center because the business creates the jobs, and most adult learners are interested in getting a job. So they're thinking, well, what do I need to learn to get a job that pays better and maybe has more flexibility? So the visibility with the employers and what they need, what positions do they need filled, and what skills do they need people to have, and what knowledge and abilities and mindsets, that's kind of, to some degree, the first mover, because that's what learners come for.
Mm-hmm.
Then you say, well, the educators clearly play a big role because they have to create the material to create those skills and that knowledge.
Right.
And they don't always have a good connection, the educators and the employers, so that the educators know, you know, what are employers looking for, and things are changing quickly. So how can you keep up with that? So the educators have a big role to play. And then finally, there's government, at least finally in our model of kind of institutional ecosystem, there's the government, where the government plays a number of different roles. A lot of it is identifying populations who need better access.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is the funding to provide the kind of service. But, you know, like in the state of New York, we've seen some really cool things where the Department of Labor has created a workforce development program so that every unemployed person in New York has access to Coursera.
Wow.
And the Department of Labor went and talked to each of the different regions of New York, the employers, and said, what kinds of skills are you looking for? And created special learning programs depending on the part of New York that the citizen is in.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to the City University of New York and the State University of New York system and started coordinating so that on August 3rd, we're going to announce that for SUNY, in SUNY Empire, which is their online college with 125 degrees, they're going to accept credit for any ACE recommended course on Coursera, of which we have 25 to 30. So now there's a really neat interplay between the Department of Labor helping underemployed people
mm-hmm.
get access to education that's curated based on employers' needs. And that pathway to a job can also be a pathway to a college degree where you get credit at SUNY for taking a course from Google or IBM.
Wow. I didn't realize that my good friend, Spencer King over there, was so progressive. Sounds like a great program.
Well, and look, it's certainly happening in the educational domain, in labor. Of course, many governments are training up their workforce. Many state governors are saying, mm-hmm. we don't want to require a college degree. We want to do skills-based hiring.
Right.
How can we skill people through alternative routes? And a lot of this online learning can help to do that. With the California State Library, this was super cool as well. Uh-huh. The library system basically bought licenses. It's like a new type of library book.
Mm-hmm.
So 25,000 Californians now have access to Coursera through the California State Library system. And so they get access, you know, to the best universities and companies in the world. And now we're using AI to provide personal coaching to any California citizen with a library card.
I'm going to have to get my library card.
That's right.
I think I lost it. You've talked about a lot of different partnerships. How do most learners find Coursera?
You know, most of them go into Google
mm-hmm.
and they search for something. Usually it's like, I want a job in data science or online course in, you know, leadership or UX design. So most of the traffic comes to Coursera through search engine optimization. Now, we don't usually pay for ads, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a lot of the secret is this, Eloy. It turns out when you have courses from the top universities and businesses, your search results rank really, really high because people trust them. So that they call it authority. So the authority of our partners really helps people find us pretty easily. So most people come through the internet, which, you know, in Coursera for Business, those are employees who are introduced to Coursera by their employers. In campuses, the students are introduced to Coursera by their teachers. And then in governments, you know, a citizen in California could be introduced to Coursera through the California State Library system.
All right. Well, let's talk about how Coursera is harnessing the power of generative AI or GAI. A lot has been talked about since the launch of ChatGPT earlier this year. How are you and your team thinking about incorporating GAI into your platform, and what does this mean for your learners?
We were sort of tracking this whole generative AI evolution it's been around for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I think 2017, Google wrote this seminal paper about this new neural network technology around attention, which is a way of kind of emphasizing certain parts of this neural network. And that sort of gave rise to generative AI. I mean, honestly, my team was kind of watching it. They were saying, hey, Jeff, you know, pay attention. And I was kind of paying attention. But I'll be totally honest. It wasn't until ChatGPT, you know, GPT 3.5 was a big advance. Mm-hmm. And they made it public. And I got my own account in early December. And I freaked out. I was just like, as an English major, I mean, it's crazy, Eloy, yeah. Right? This is the first time in my life I could like talk to a computer. And it was really amazing. Like stunning to me. I mean, there was Arthur Clarke, I think, said any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. And that's how I felt. I was like, this is magic. And now not perfect. It has flaws, it has errors, it has risks, et cetera. Well, we could talk about all that, but I was just stunned by the capability. So what we did is we immediately convened a team in early January, and we identified a few different ways that AI was going to impact Coursera. And they've all been basically turning out to be true. But like to a large degree, situational awareness is the first thing that a CEO's got to do when things are changing. So first of all, we're like, wow, this could change the way that people learn. So having a personal learning assistant who is, you know, totally personalized and interactive. And so it's like every learner having their own tutor. We call it coach.
Right.
It's very, very cool. And others are starting to do this as well. I think we'll have many of these things around, but it really is extraordinary how effective the personalized learning can be. So that's number one, it's kind of personalized interactive learning for the end learner. Mm-hmm. Number two is something we're building called Course Builder. This is helping our partners generate courses and update courses and generate new audio and video and text and things. So the ability to generate content, although you got to make sure that it's not hallucinating and that the factuality is high. You know, the ability to generate content is being, you know, radically transformed, just not just language, but sound and images as well. Mm-hmm. Second big thing. The third, which I'm flying out to Indonesia and Thailand in 2 weeks, we're announcing global translation of 2,000 courses in the next 60 days into 7 different languages.
Wow.
But effectively, AI will eliminate the language barrier for asynchronous learning online. So basically, any learner in almost any language will be able to learn from any professor or instructor in almost any language. So that will be super cool. And then a fourth one is that we need more AI content on the platform. So a lot more people are coming to Coursera to learn about AI because it's such a hot topic. The fifth one is that jobs are changing. So lots of people's jobs, especially in marketing, in legal, anyone who works with language, computer programmers,
right.
Jobs are going to be completely transformed. So they're going to need to get reskilled. And then the final one, I guess this is number six, is that we at Coursera, we're retooling the way we do our work so that, you know, we're putting in more automated processes utilizing this new generative AI to, you know, whether that's writing marketing copy or for me, I'm using it for decision-making. I make a lot of decisions. I'm not asking, you know, I'm not just going with whatever the GPT says, but I have it as a thought partner and I'm kind of talking to ChatGPT all day long in my job.
Well, I'm going to date myself, but I'm having visions of hell.
Well, you know, luckily I can still turn it off. The problem with hell is they couldn't turn him off.
Oh my goodness. All right. Well, let's talk about your learning platform, and many leaders in traditional higher education and many policymakers, I know certainly many here in California and throughout the country, they still raise doubts about the use of online learning and the use of technology in education. What do you say to people who still doubt the power of technology to increase access to quality learning?
The first thing that I would say is, when you have over 100 million people, 80% of them are not in the United States.
Right.
Almost 50% of them are women. And in our STEM enrollments, something like 38% are women, which is not 50%, but it's definitely been climbing. Mm-hmm. The numbers don't lie. I mean, the numbers just don't lie. We're now a publicly traded company worth a couple billion dollars because turns out we're really meeting people's needs, you know, from people around the world.
Right.
Now, it's not to say it's perfect. And I think where I do say, well, you know, you do have a point is that, you know, technology will not be able to do, especially for younger people. Mm-hmm. I mean, adolescents and anyone K through 12, in my view, having, you know, been there myself and raising three daughters who are now all in their late 20s, early 30s, a lot of learning is social. So, no, I think it would be dystopian and horrendous. And we saw a taste of it during COVID. If our younger people went to school and it was all technology, that's not the kind of learning that we need to do. We need a lot more social learning. But for working adults who are looking for a better job, who want to learn some skills to, you know, advance their careers and get more opportunity and pay, technology, online learning, and some of these advances has been just absolutely, unequivocally, demonstrably effective. Not perfect and not in every single domain, but just overwhelmingly effective in providing incredible opportunities for, you know, tens of millions of people. So,
right.
Yeah, it's kind of a question of what role should it play and what role should it not play? I mean, it will not replace humans, but boy, does it certainly provide a lot more access to high quality education.
Well, I think you made the point here, which is it's not about replacing the existing pedagogy and the existing learning for a whole host of people who have the ability to access a good residential, traditional higher education experience. But it expands the myriad of opportunities for people who are in different parts and points in their life, who want to access knowledge, who want to access skills. And so I think that's where it plays an important role. And of course, on the flip side, I spend a lot of time talking about how traditional higher education isn't perfect either. And it's not built for every learner. So I think the more options and the more opportunities we have to personalize learning for every individual, I think the better off we will be in.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I mean, if you look at technology, say, with computers, when they first were created, the computer sat on a desk and it could do certain things. I mean, what it did really well was Lotus 1-2-3. Like the spreadsheet was the killer app of the personal computer back in the 80s. But as technology starts morphing into phones, it starts getting into different elements of our lives and the way that you can use it expands. You hit on something I think is really important. Traditional education has served certain populations really well and really effectively. But it has failed to serve an awful lot of populations that really need and deserve to have similar kinds of opportunities. And so, especially for your working people with lower levels of education, people who have less money, who can't afford to quit their job because sometimes they're working two or three, don't have a car, or maybe their spouse takes their car, so they don't have good access to transportation and they're caring for other family members, so they can't show up at a campus at a certain point in time. I mean, yeah, technology is not perfect, but the current higher education system is not serving everybody perfectly either. And I think that together, you have technology with some of the better parts of traditional education can serve a lot more people a lot more effectively.
Well, I certainly agree with that point. So let me pose this question to you as we begin to close, and I appreciate you taking all this time out of your schedule to talk with us. But where do you see Coursera going over the next 5 years, given all the technology advances that you've seen?
It's getting harder and harder to predict because, like you said, the technology is coming faster and faster. Right. Clearly, AI will be a big part of that future. But, you know, AI, I see that much more as an enabler and potentially a threat. It's something that we have to kind of deal with. It can make it an opportunity or else it will be a threat. But it is definitely a change this year. But when I think about where we need to go as a company, I think about, well, who do we need to serve? I'm really excited about the way we're doing the translations. I think we can serve a more global population. And it sounds very perhaps, you know, basic, but obviously having the content in a language that people can speak, that's pretty important for accessibility. Right. Having payment systems, you know, not everybody uses credit cards. And so being more accessible to people around the world is a big part of that. And that has to do with language and affordability and payments. It also includes working through institutions like governments and campuses and businesses to provide that kind of learning support. Mm-hmm. So greater global access is a major thing. I like to have, you know, hundreds of millions of learners, not just 100 and whatever million now. Another major focus is going to be connecting learning to job opportunities. Mm-hmm. If you have a college degree and you have a nice long work experience, LinkedIn works great.
Right.
If you don't have a college degree and you want to switch careers into something that pays better, That's not easy. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you don't have a college degree and you don't have any LinkedIn. How do I know if I should hire you or not? And people talk about skills-based hiring, which is really important to afford more opportunities to people. But how do you do that? And, mm-hmm. and what we're trying to do, we just announced Coursera Hiring Solutions in April, is now all of the learners on Coursera can build personal sort of skill profiles that they can show to an employer.
Mm-hmm.
And we can allow employers to find people who have skills, even if those people don't have a lot of work experience and a college degree. Another piece of what we're doing and really pushing on is this idea of bridging industry and higher education. So what higher education does really well is college degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome, but you know, we got to make them more affordable and flexible. What industry has done really well, and it's really turbocharging a lot of our consumer segment, are these professional certificates. And these are 50 to 100 hours.
Right.
What we're seeing globally, and it's very exciting, is we're working with the ACE, the American Council on Education.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing credit recommendations for these industry professional certificates. And then colleges are implementing these as career electives in their four-credit curricula. So another major sort of trend for us is going to be bridging the gap between industry and higher education via what you might call career electives, these industry professional certificates that integrated mm-hmm. and count as prior learning, you know, towards college degrees. So that's another one. And then finally, we talked a little bit about AI, but clearly as an enabler, AI will be a big part of what we do in terms of personalized interactive learning with personalized feedback, course content generation for our partners, and then a lot of the jobs transitions have to do as well with job opportunities. Like, how can we help people get access to the new jobs that will be created and deal with some of the disruption that's going to be coming?
Well, I think those are all great things to look forward to, especially when you think about how to better support learners who want to connect to those jobs. And Jeff, I really appreciate you taking the time to tell us about what you're doing, to tell us more about Coursera. So thanks for being with me here on The Rant.
Thank you so much, Eloy. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, you've been listening to my conversation with Jeff as we've been talking about the evolution of Coursera and where they're going into the future. Lots of exciting stuff. So if you enjoyed this episode, hit the like button. Let me know your thoughts in the comments about Coursera, about skills-based hiring, about the use of GAI. If you are following us on this YouTube channel, subscribe and continue to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll see you soon.